The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good morning, listeners. Welcome to the Friday morning California time space show program. And I'm your host, David Livingston. Thank you very much for tuning in. And we have a great show with one of our favorite guests who is back with us, Dr. Landis. More on that in just a moment. A couple of quick announcements. We're going for a full 90-minute version space show today. But still, if you want to talk with our guest or send in emails, make sure you do it while we are still broadcasting and not after the show is already shut down for the day. Our toll-free number, excuse me, is 866-687-7223. We are a talk show, so we do prefer talking over other forms of communication. But if you do want to email us, if that works better for you, it is Dr. Space, DRSPACE, at thespaceshow.com. You can also post a comment on our blog, which is our website, thespaceshow.com. Scroll all the way over to the right, then down on the upcoming show menu, and you'll see this show with Dr. Landis is the first one. And you can post comments or ask questions down at the bottom. As soon as you hit your send button, I get a copy of it and can bring it all up on air. Our website newsletter is up and it will change on Sunday morning, but you'll see all of the programming left for this week, which is today and Sunday open lines. And you will also see the programs that we have planned for between now and the end of the year, and that will also be revised on Sunday morning. Don't forget we have a store if you're interested in logo wear. It's starting to get close to gift-giving time. I find that hard to believe, but it is. So you might find stocking stuffer or other ideas for your Space Show listener, family, friends, or just friends. And you get there by clicking on any of the pictures of Pepper listening to the Space Show, and you go directly to our Cafe Press store. So remember that everything we do is archived. You can listen right off of our website or quickly download a program. We podcast as well as have compressed MP3s as archives on our website. And if you go to the upper left menu, you'll see Listen Live. This tells you how to listen to all of our live broadcasts, archive sites, archive shows off of our website, and then podcasts. If you have any questions, best to email me, drspace@thespaceshow.com. One more quick announcement is that we are a 501c3 nonprofit, and we are supported by listeners just like you listening to this show. Your support allows us to have these great guests and to continue doing these programs. So as a nonprofit, if you're a U.S. federal taxpayer, you get a tax deduction gift for your donation. The same is true if you're a California taxpayer. And our website for the nonprofit, our parent, is oneonegiantleapfoundation.org. So if you have any questions or comments about the nonprofit or supporting us or contributing, please email me. And the best way to do that is drspace@thespaceshow.com. Remember also we have sponsors, and they get the banner ad going across the homepage. And when we take a short break between first and second segment today, I will read sponsor-created messages for all of you. PayPal is at the top of every one of our pages. That is the easiest way to support us. And you can also send a check in the mail to One Giant Leap Foundation, Box 95, Tiburon, California. And that now takes me into our program. So I'm very, very happy to have Dr. Jeffrey Landis back with us. So his full extensive and detailed bio is on our website. But Dr. Landis is an actual scientist. He is with NASA at the Glenn Research Center. He has received many, many different awards. He's published more than 400 scientific papers. He holds about 8 patents or so. Read his bio. He is also a very active and very well-known and award-winning science fiction author. Many of his works are detailed on his bio on our website. But we want to talk to him specifically about the work he's doing with Mars. Jeff Webb, welcome back to the Space Show. How are you today?
Hey, it's great to be back on the show. Doing great. Sort of hanging out and not seeing a whole lot of people, but doing a lot of work virtually.
Well, Mars is always in the news, if not from our missions to Mars and NASA, but also Mr. Musk and SpaceX and what they're doing. So what are you doing with Mars?
Well, actually, I'm doing a lot of studies of future spacecraft design. Kind of something I wanted to talk about a little bit was some work that we did in the past, and that was looking at making rocket propellant on the surface of Mars, something I'm still extremely interested in. NASA has a program to do sample return from Mars coming up. Right now, that program does not use rocket propellant made on Mars, but I sure would like to see that. We're advocating that.
Speaking of sample return, this is a little out of the order that we probably would have talked about things, but that has become extremely controversial due to the COVID-19 panic. And now I think, at least with Space Show audience, it's probably weighted in favor of being extremely cautious given something may come here and cause the Andromeda strain to be reality. And, of course, others don't believe that, and we should be doing sample return, and it would be okay to bring it back to Earth. Where do you stand with sample return?
Well, NASA actually has an Office of Planetary Protection, and that office protects not merely Mars, protecting Mars from Earth bacteria, but it's also designed to protect Earth from the possibility of Mars bacteria. So the first thing I'd say is, yeah, there's a lot of people that are working very hard. Samples returned from Mars would be treated as a biological danger until we know that they're not. So it would be the same biological isolation protocol of smallpox or Ebola. So there's a lot of people that are thinking about how we absolutely make sure that the samples don't get exposed to human beings until we've checked them and made sure there's nothing living in it.
So can you bring them back to Earth and check them? Or a lot of people say ISS or build a high-tech lab on the moon or do something else, but don't bring it back to Earth.
Yeah, man, I'd love to see that high-tech lab on the moon, but right now we don't have that. So, yes, the idea is to bring them back to the Earth, but they would be brought back in very sealed containers.
And you'd be okay with that?
I would be okay because, to tell you the truth, Charles Darwin told us that organisms evolve to be well adapted to the environment they live on. And anything that could live in the environment of Mars would have to be a hypercryophile. It would have to be good with incredibly cold temperatures. It would have to be radiation tolerant. And most of all, it would be to have to be a halophile. It would have to be very strongly resistant against ultra-saline environments. Because Mars is very salty, with both ordinary salts and also with the perchlorate salt. But anything that could live in that environment would look at the Earth and say, oh, my God, I can't live here. There's too much oxygen. There's too much water. This is poison. So I'm really not worried. Anything adapted to Mars would find Earth to be a hostile place indeed.
Making oxygen off of the surface and the ingredients on Mars and making rocket fuel, is it theoretical or is it actually, engineering and scientific fact?
both. Certainly, we've done a lot of work showing that if we could make a good oxygen production facility on Mars, and of course oxygen by weight is the major component of rocket fuel, that it would be extremely valuable, not just for human missions, although it's probably the enabling factor for human missions, but it could also make sample return missions lower in cost and larger in samples. But there's also been a lot of experimental work done. There's been a lot of new reactors called the Sabatier reactions that react the carbon dioxide atmosphere with basically water, although you have to split off the hydrogen, and that can make methane and oxygen rocket fuel. The rocket fuel experiment that I worked on for many years, back actually in the closing years of the 1990s, was just looking at making oxygen. Again, we picked oxygen because it is so much the heaviest part of rocket fuel. And we did this by taking carbon dioxide and splitting off one oxygen atom off of the carbon dioxide molecule and then turning that into pure oxygen that we could use to fuel a rocket with. And that turns out to be a relatively straightforward chemical reaction that we can do. It turns out the high-temperature chemical reaction, we were running this at about 750 degrees, but we made a demonstration unit to show that we could do it on Mars.
Is doing this equipment heavy to get onto Mars? I'm assuming it could be automatic and robotic, but does it need a lot of equipment, and does that equipment exist? Do you just like take equipment from Earth and bring it up to Mars, or do you have to design things specifically for Mars?
Well, we can make the equipment on Earth. There's a couple of things that we need to change, of course, for Mars. One thing is that we do need to put it in a insulated enclosure so that we don't leak some power out because it's a high temperature. But mostly it's the same. There's an experiment that's on its way to Mars right now on the Mars Perseverance rover that'll land in February. There's an experiment called MOXIE, the Mars Oxygen In-Situ Production Experiment. And I do have to say that's not my experiment. It's an MIT experiment with Mike Hecht, the principal investigator. It actually is building on an experiment that I was part of several years ago, the MIP, Mars In-Situ Propellant Production Precursor. But this one is small enough that it's about the size of a shoebox. Just to demonstrate that there's no showstoppers, we can make oxygen on Mars, and to show that it works. We can compress the atmosphere, we can electrolyze the atmosphere to get out the oxygen, and then we can liquefy the oxygen and put it in a tank. So I'm really hoping this is going to show that it's workable, and we can start thinking about further missions where we actually use this, fly rockets off of Mars, and eventually fly them back to Earth.
This has prompted an email question already from listener Todd in San Diego, and he says, does making oxygen, what you're talking about, open the door for an actual commercial mission on Mars?
Well, if you have an economic basis for a commercial mission, certainly the ability to make your own oxygen on Mars is going to help. So I guess the question is, if it's a commercial mission, you're talking about somebody making money.
Correct.
And how are they going to make money? Are they going to make money by sending people to Mars? Certainly there's enough people who have said that they'd be willing to pay for a flight to Mars. And if you were going to do that, sure, absolutely. Making the rocket fuel on Mars to come back home, I'm assuming your people probably want to come home. but making the rocket fuel on Mars would absolutely be the enabling technology there. You don't have to ship the rocket fuel from Earth.
But
just make it there.
The process of making the fuel itself would not be commercial because, from what I'm hearing, without a commercial user, just because you can make it doesn't make it a commercial money-making proposition.
Well, you need a user.
You need a user.
The question is, who are you going to sell oxygen to?
For your own personal thoughts, I mean, yeah, there's no shortage of people who say, I'm ready to go to Mars, I'm ready to go to Mars. Do you think we are ready to put humans on Mars? Could they survive the trip? Could they survive on Mars? Do we know enough about how to deal with human factors and other things to keep them alive if they get to Mars alive?
We're not ready yet, but it's an engineering challenge. And turns out human beings are pretty good at engineering. So we know what the problems are, and we know what we need to do to solve the problem. We don't yet have the equipment. We haven't really done the detailed nuts and bolts design of a Mars transport spacecraft or a Mars lander or the Mars habitat. But these are engineering details. We could know how to do it. So if we put our minds to it, we could go to Mars. We'd have to invent some new hardware. We'd have to build some new spacecraft. But we know what we need to know what we need to learn.
That includes on the medical side, too? That's also engineering?
On the medical side, it's engineering, and there's things that you're going to have to do. I very much think that if we're going to make a long-duration trip, for example, a trip to Mars with astronauts, we're probably going to want to use centrifugal gravity to get there. Because we know from a lot of time and space, the space station among others, that your health does somewhat degrade when you're exposed to microgravity for a long time. Now, the other thing we've learned on space station is that with a very vigorous exercise program, putting a lot of work into it, you can slow down at that rate. You do lose some bone mass, but with exercising that puts stress on the skeletal system, you can slow down that bone mass loss. You can slow down or even stop the degradation of your muscles. So it's possible to do countermeasures against microgravity, but the straightforward way to do it would be to use centrifugal gravity to put a spacecraft perhaps with two pieces that rotate around each other on a tether.
So it seems like there's a lot of talk supporting that, and there certainly is no shortage of papers and books and passages being written about that. But when I look around at the past 20 years of doing the space show, we're almost at 20 years, I don't see a lot of talk getting put into action. Where is anyone working on this? Where is the hardware being designed to do this? Is this just all show and talk, or is there really a movement or an approach going on? Is money being spent? Are people really working to design this?
Yeah, the interesting thing is that it is so straightforward. This is a technology that Isaac Newton could have designed in his spare time while he was inventing calculus. There's not a whole lot of engineering difficulty in the idea of using a rotating spacecraft and tethers. So the key to it is the idea that you have a tether. You have a spacecraft with several pieces that can rotate around each other. Tether experiments have been done. Most publicity came from the space shuttle tether missions, the TSS satellite, tethered satellite system that demonstrated the main features of the tether. Unfortunately, most of the publicity was about the parts of the experiment that didn't work, but there were other parts that quite did. What people tend to forget is that there's been a number of other experiments that were done without the humans. not from the space shuttle that demonstrated that tethers could go out, they could be deployed. It's a very straightforward technology.
So
I think, interestingly, the tether part, the artificial gravity part, is you don't see much work on it because it's a solved problem. There really isn't a whole lot of difficulty there. It would be nice to demonstrate it, but there's not a, it's not real exciting in doing something that everybody knows that it can work.
So the shortage is the demonstration hardware to just go up and do it. And
yeah.
So I have a weird question that maybe you can comment on or not. It really doesn't have anything to do with this, but then it's coming because of this discussion. And it's kind of personal to me, but what the hell, I'm going to ask you anyway. So lots of us, as we age, lose bone mass. We get osteoporosis for a whole variety of reasons. And so I'm wondering, and so I just had another DEXA scan. They do them every 2 years. And I see bone mass going bye-bye at 74. If they had spinning gravity chambers on Earth, and they could put me in one where I walk around, do push-ups, do exercises at a higher gravity level than 1G, like maybe 1.5G or 2G, would that do for a human on Earth, stop the bone mass loss, like doing exercises do on the space station? Could you get that same benefit, do you think, by treating people, having them going into a higher gravity chamber and do some physical activity a couple of times a week, maybe, for 2G or something like that?
Yes, I'm sure that you could do that, probably just doing a lot of vigorous exercise in and of itself would help improve your bone mass. But, yeah, absolutely. The growth of bones is, to some extent, proportional to the stress that you put on them. That's nature making a homeostatic system. So if you spend your time in hypergravity, sort of the opposite of microgravity, your bones are going to adapt and increase your bone mass. Yeah, absolutely.
So it might be easier to walk around in a gravity chamber. Many people can't do exercises, you know, when they get older. They have different problems and stuff like that. But they could probably walk around and move around and, you know, get resistance that way, or maybe do some push-ups or something. Just a thought. I've never seen that proposed, and when I've asked doctors, they don't really know much about it or don't care to comment about it. But maybe some enterprising entrepreneur might come up with gravity chambers in a shopping center and, you know, go in for 2G for an hour and a half for $50 or something and get your workout just walking around or bouncing a ball or something.
Yeah, I do have to say that there's enough people that have the treadmills and rowing machines and other apparatus that just sort of gather dust and are used to dry laundry on, that I'm thinking that, well, having one more apparatus to gather dust might be,
well,
might be one thing too much.
They could program Mars on the wall, you know, and you could go for a hike on Mars or something, so, you know, in higher gravity. Anyway, you have a phone call from a listener. Hi, caller. Welcome to our program today. Who are you and where are you, please?
Hi, this is Kim in Mexico.
Hi, Kim. Welcome to hearing you again. How are you doing?
I'm pretty good. I wanted to ask you, Dr. Landis, about the reactor, because I just thought about the difficulties of running a reaction at that temperature remotely and with elemental oxygen being involved. Is the material the difficult problem, or how do you keep it hot enough and whole?
Yes, it's a solvable problem. 750 C seems pretty hot, but actually for chemical engineering processes, that's just sort of a routine process. But absolutely, the thermal design is a major trick for that. The experiment we did actually stayed hot in Mars conditions with only 9.5 watts of heating to keep it at temperature. So the thermal design to keep the heat leak low seemed to work. As for the oxygen, the technology that we use is called solid oxide electrolysis. There's many different technologies that you could use, but the one that we found simplest is solid oxide electrolysis. So interestingly, the carbon dioxide is dissociated with a catalyst on one side of a zirconia membrane. It turns out that the doped zirconia is a material in which oxygen ions are actually conductive. So the oxygen ions move through the zirconia membrane under the influence of a electric field. And then on the other side of the membrane, we recombine two oxygen ions, pull off the spare electron, and then get an oxygen molecule. So it turns out the actually reactive oxygen ions are never free. They're always inside this zirconia crystal. So not terribly reactive. We don't have to worry about the oxygen ions. Like, for example, we worry about oxygen ions in space. They're confined inside the zirconium dioxide crystal.
Interesting. But that's a catalyst process? You can keep using the zirconium over and over?
Yes, yeah. The zirconium is not actually used in the reaction. It's just the electrolyte. It turns out it's an electrolyte that's a solid rather than a liquid. You're probably familiar with the high school chemistry experiment where you electrolyze water. Well, this is pretty much the same technology, except instead of using water as the solvent, you're dissolving the oxygen ions in the zirconium, zirconia dioxide.
So this reactor design, it can last on its own for a long time, or what would be its shelf life kind of thing?
The shelf life is pretty long. It turns out the hardest thing that we found on these reactors was thermal cycling. If you turn it on and turn it off, that gives it a little bit of thermal shock. So you can turn them on and off, and we demonstrated you can turn them on and off. But that's ultimately going to be the worst problem, is if you turn it on and off and on and off and on and off enough times, probably something will end up breaking. The thermal shock.
So solving those problems, the thermal problems, would that apply to any reactor that's used in space in other situations?
Different reactors have different temperatures of operation. So most of them tend to operate at higher temperatures, but depending on which chemical production plant you're using, it'll be a different temperature.
But this is the first time. It would be the first time that a reactor, a hot reactor like that, would be used in space, wouldn't it?
There's other reactors that we use to do other things. For example, the Sabatier reaction is sometimes used to recover products from carbon dioxide. That's a little bit lower temperature. That's typically between maybe 300 and 400 degrees C. But there's different types of chemical reactions that do different things.
That's been done in space already?
That's been done in a space station.
Oh. Well, I'm just really interested in hot reactors in space for processes on the moon. That's the part that I'm really interested in. And this sounds really different, but at the same time, I hope that that meant that designs for the mostly hotter processes that you'd have to do on the moon wouldn't have to be a lot different than that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's
some of the moon processes look at creating oxygen out of moon rock. And for several of them, you have to bring the rock all the way up to melting temperature, which, depending, can be pretty hot. Some of the proposed reactions for the moon have been over 1,000 degrees C, so it's getting pretty hot there.
So that extra 250 degrees is a big difference.
It's a big difference. yeah. The sort of 300 or 400 degrees of the body A is a little bit less of a thermal problem than the 750 of the zirconia electrolysis. But the nice thing about the zirconia solid oxide electrolysis is it really has no moving parts. There's no chemicals to put in. Just carbon dioxide comes in one end. The waste product, carbon monoxide, goes out. And the oxygen comes out, and there's no real moving parts except the pumps to pump the reacting products in and out.
Which you could switch for a new one if it broke, I suppose.
Yes.
Oh, that sounds perfect, all right.
What happens to the carbon monoxide? Does it stay carbon monoxide, or does it change its chemical composition later on, or what?
We just eject the carbon monoxide into the Martian atmosphere. Turns out, actually, carbon monoxide is already a component of the carbon dioxide atmosphere. It's not pure carbon dioxide. So it's not as if we're polluting the Martian atmosphere. There's already plenty of carbon monoxide there.
So adding more doesn't make a big difference one way or the other?
No. We're just putting in something that's already there.
Okay, Kim, anything else? Or?
No, you know, I wish I knew a little more in order to pick his brain a little more. But that sounds like a beautiful piece of technology. I really hope that mission flies.
Well, it is. Actually, the test mission is flying right now. And I do have to give credit to the MIT team that's working with JPL. So the one flying to Mars is not my experiment. That's led by Mark Hecht at MIT.
This is the MOXIE experiment.
The MOXIE experiment.
On Perseverance, right?
Right.
Okay.
Right. So wait till February. We'll see if it works.
Okay. So I'm sorry because I seem to be confused then. You talked about two different experiments. But
yes.
You know what? I'll go back and listen to the show again afterwards. I don't want to take up more time.
Well, there are actually two different experiments to demonstrate the same thing. The experiment that I had worked on was called MIP, the Mars In-Situ Propellant Production Precursor. And then the MOXIE experiment was somewhat later. That's the MIT experiment collaborating with JPL. That's the one that's flying to Mars.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, then It's wonderful. It would make a big difference, I suppose. Okay, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Kim.
Thank you.
Listeners, Kim has cleared our phone line. If you would like to call us, it is 866-687-7223. You have George in Santa Fe, New Mexico, with an email. And he says, how applicable are these experiments on Mars to further research and somehow starting habitation on the moon?
It's applicable because for habitation on the moon, we're also, of course, going to want to use the in-situ resources, but we also are going to want to produce oxygen out of, among other things, exhausting carbon dioxide. I think it's most applicable in that what we're really going to show is that we've been talking about in-situ resource utilization for decades. We've been saying the key to base settlement is you've got to use the stuff that you can find. You can't ship everything from Earth. And this, just for the first time, is going to be showing that. Going to prove, yes, we can make useful things out of resources that we find at the destination.
And that will transfer to the moon as well?
Absolutely. There's a lot of in-situ resources on the moon. We just have to get the technology to use them.
Do you have a plausible timeline for humans going to Mars?
I have to say it's more of a political question than a technical question. So the timeline will be whenever we decide we want to do it. When we picked the moon as a destination for spaceflight, we went from the announcement that we choose to go to the moon to the landing on the moon in less than a decade. So we can move pretty fast technically when we have to. With that said, the demonstration missions take a little bit longer because it's, of course, a 9-month trip to Mars. Typically varies a little bit depending on the orbital mechanics. And we would, of course, want to make sure that we had everything tested out before we start sending the humans. So maybe a little bit longer than 10 years after we say that we're going to go. But the main question is, the will to do it. If we have the will to do it, we could start moving. We could do it.
How would you make the case to convince people to do it? I'm assuming you think it's important to do. Why would you tell people or go testify before Congress that we should have the will to do it?
Well, that has always been a hard problem for the space advocates. It just seems so obvious that this is something we should do that it's one of those things that say, man, if you can't already tell, how can I explain it to you? But I think basically human beings are exploring animals. That's what we do. Humans explore. Humans find new frontiers and move to the new frontiers and settle new frontiers. A lot of people have pointed out that the frontier has been an essence of humanity for a long time. And a problem with the world now is that there aren't a whole lot of frontiers left on the Earth. If we want to go out and explore new places, well, it's space, the final frontier. That's where we need to go to explore.
You have another email question, and this is Sandra, who is in Denver. And Sandra says, do you have any preference or thoughts with the private sector going to Mars, and possibly they might have a much faster, much quicker, but maybe riskier timeline than what NASA might have? How do you see that, or does that matter to you?
Oh, I love it. I would just absolutely love to see the private sector go to Mars. And that is somewhat of a truth, is that to some extent, the private sector is allowed to take more risks. When we have something that's the national program, it tends to be very risk-averse, because every time there's an accident, well, you get a congressional investigation. So if the private sector is able to do some exploration and maybe take risks, and what they say is, well, with great risk comes the potential for great reward. So I would just absolutely love to see the private sector moving forward on a trip to Mars. That would be great.
Do you have any inside information on how that is shaping up and private sector plausible timelines, or you're not plugged into that world?
Well, I have to say I'm looking at the same news items that you are in the same companies, some of which look like they have some great plans. I'm saying, well, let's wait and see if they can come up with the technology to match. But if they can, I am absolutely cheering them on.
Don is also in Denver. Two Denvers back to back. And he said, if we're looking for space settlement, it seems to me that you have the people that want to do free space settlements, like O'Neill colonies, people advocating for the moon, people advocating for Mars. People for a long time have been advocating Venus. Where do you see the most likely place to start space settlement to give it a real boost and a real foothold?
I'm not sure that these are really competing with each other, because, in fact, the technologies that are useful for one will be the same technologies that are useful for all of the demonstrations. Even the free space colonies, the colonies, for example, that Gerard O'Neill had advocated back in the 1970s at the Lagrange point, well, his idea for making the Lagrange point colonies was that you would make them by materials from the moon. So if you look at his plans, there's a pretty significant moon base involved in the L5 colonies. It's not just an L5 colony, but it's an L5 colony that's supported by a moon base. So everything works together. The advantage of the moon is that it's so much more closer than Mars. So you can just sort of pop over with a three-day journey, whereas in Mars it takes a lot more delta V, it takes a lot more time. So in the near term, it does make sense to go back to the moon and probably learn some of these technologies for life support and making long-term habitat. In the longer term, well, Mars has a lot more resources. Mars has the atmosphere. Of course, the moon, we now know, does have some water, but Mars has a lot of water. So there's much to be said for Mars. Yeah, I've been one of the main advocates of colonies on Venus. I think the upper atmosphere of Venus is a wonderful environment, a very, in many ways, the most Earth-like environment in the solar system. Other than Earth. So you could say something about Venus, too. A lot of people worry about the idea that a habitat floating 55 kilometers above the surface. They say, well, what if you fell off? Well, that would not be a good idea.
Well, could you fall off? Let me ask you that question. Now, what would it take to fall off?
Well, you wouldn't, of course. That's the same as people say, well, what happens if you're in an airplane and you fall off the airplane? Well, the answer is you try to make sure that you do not fall off if you're in an airliner, and you would not want to fall off of a Venus colony.
What would the travel time be to a colony 55 kilometers up in the atmosphere on Venus from Earth? It's got to be shorter than going to Mars, right?
Yeah, the trip time to Venus is pretty short. I should look it up, but it's you know, something like 5 months or so to get to Venus. It's not a long time.
And you have another caller on hold, but if we ever did do nuclear propulsion, travel time might be reduced in magnitude of an issue, right?
Nuclear propulsion would certainly open up the solar system. It probably wouldn't reduce travel time by an order of magnitude, but it would reduce it some. And would also give us a lot more cargo capabilities. So instead of absolutely trying to shave down every single kilogram of mass, you could send more stuff. And So, yes, nuclear propulsion would be a vast improvement.
Let's see who our caller is. Hi, caller. Welcome to our program today. Who are you and where are you, please?
Hi, this is John in Fremont, California.
Hi, John. Good to hear from you again. How are you?
I'm doing well.
Go for it.
Yeah, good to speak with you, Dr. Landis. I have a question. This came up on a previous show when I called in. I think it was with Keith Crane, David. We were talking about the value of space. And when we talk about in-situ resource utilization on the moon and the cost of developing equipment and placing it on the moon and making sure everything works properly and validating that technology, it's going to be a while. And the guest on the show suggested that the cost of launch costs are coming down dramatically to the point where it's going to be cheaper to launch fuel from Earth pretty soon. And so I just wanted to get your thoughts on that. That, you know, would that put off development of the technology if you could, you know, support cislunar infrastructure by launching fuel from Earth because it was cheaper?
No, I think almost the opposite is true. If it gets cheaper to launch from Earth, more and more people are going to be looking for applications at going out into space, and it's going to really increase the amount of interest in using the space resources. It's like, oh, think about, I don't know, ships coming from Europe to North America. Well, when ships got more efficient and we were sending more people to North America, this didn't decrease the amount of people using the resources of North America. It drove the resource utilization of North America to a much higher level. So I think that would be likewise for launch costs from Earth. The launch cost drops,
sense.
The more we want to we want to use it.
Yeah, that definitely makes sense. All right, well, I didn't have anything else, David. I'll let someone else call in.
Okay, so Jeff, what you're basically saying is that as it becomes cheaper to launch from Earth, there's more demand and more opportunity to go into space, which will afford more ISRU and related opportunities. So those costs will also come down, as they'll no longer just be one-off from now and then to something not approaching an assembly line, but certainly to something approaching more demand, which usually lowers cost.
Yeah. Absolutely. The more customers you have, the more the price is driven down.
Except in pharmaceuticals.
Well.
John, thank you very much for your call. I appreciate it, okay?
Talk to you later.
You have a good weekend. Listeners, John is off of our line. The toll-free number is 866-687-7223. Jeff, I need to pause for about 2 minutes to break for our sponsors. So,
okay. See you after the break.
So hang on the line, and I'll be right back. And listeners, we do have our sponsorships, and they do get the banner ad going across the homepage, which they can change whenever they want. And our sponsors have important messages that they like to give to all of you. So Northrop Grumman, as you know, is a leading global security company with innovative systems, solutions, and products. And they have a worldwide base for customers. They have lots of capabilities, undersea, outer space, cyberspace. The Space Foundation sponsors us, and they have the really terrific Space Symposium. and not sure what they're planning for, having missed it this year, or what they're going to do next year, but find out all about it at spacesymposium.org. And they usually have their symposiums around the end of April, the end of March, first part of April, always in Colorado Springs at the Broadmoor Hotel. Astrox has been involved in hypersonic space plane and reusable rocket designs for the Air Force, DARPA, and NASA for more than 30 years. Their codes, HiSight and SpaceSight, create and analyze these designs. You can visit them at Astrox, ASTROX.com, for more information. AIAA sponsors us, the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics. It remains the world's largest aerospace professional society. Typically, they have multiple events, including 5 big events a year, and a lot of regional meetings, breakfast meetings, lunch and dinner meetings. Everything's virtual this year. But check them out for their plans. Their events are great. The networking is really exceptional. And they have a terrific peer-reviewed library going back decades that you can access, AIAA.org. And Moonwords sponsors us. You just heard from Kim a few minutes ago with her questions. But what if a group of nations was determined to build a town on the moon? They based their decisions only on technical and economic merit. Moonwords is building a digital vision of that town where you will be able to learn, play, build, and even go to events. Visit Moonwords.com, download an early draft demo of the town, and fund its development by subscribing. Help Moonwords see the world, see a bigger future where we can leave our past behind us. Those of you that are on Twitter and are following Moonwords, you're seeing some of the advanced design concepts that Kim is working on, so I certainly urge you to follow Kim and Moonwords on Twitter. You'll really appreciate what you see. And then Celestis sponsors us, and they are still the guys or the company to launch Memorial space flights with remains on board. So if you want to memorialize a loved one or a friend with part of your cremated remains or DNA or something like that, this is a great way to do that. You can also add a little bit of your DNA to go with your loved one for a symbolic joint trip. And they do suborbital. They have a flight going to the moon. It'll be their second flight to the moon. And down the road, they will have free space flights as well as probably Mars flights. So if you have any questions or you want more information, contact Celestis at celestis.com. And for full disclosure, I am their customer, having done multiple flights with my mom and my dogs. The National Space Society sponsors us. So they do the great ISDC event. They have the quarterly publication Ad Astra, which is exceptional. They do white papers on space solar power, settlement, and much more. Check them out at space.nss.org and get the latest on their ISDC 2021 plans for Los Angeles and lots more. And we appreciate their being with us. And then the Integrated Space Plan is a sponsor with a highly detailed development chart showing the path to becoming a spacefaring race. You can see how technologies and destinations build upon one another. Explore hundreds of individual elements on the virtual one. You can buy your own copy of the plan, and you can get all that information at thespaceplan.com. We do have sponsorships available, and you get that banner ad, you get the message, and these messages appear on the archives program. So as long as people keep playing these programs, and they still do, going back to 2001, your message is going to continue to be heard. So it's a great deal. For further information, email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. And listeners, we're into part two of our program today with Dr. Landis. Dr. Landis, people are sort of really anxious, I think, to see real movement in human spaceflight, in space settlement to announcing that there is probably at least past life on Mars, but everybody just keeps waiting. Are we expecting too much, too fast?
I wish I could answer that. I wish things moved faster. I've been waiting since the 1960s to see humans back to the moon and humans onward to Mars. So I think we have every right to expect too much. It's a big universe out there. Let's get moving. Let's explore it.
And you're a supporter of commercial enterprise in space, I assume, space mining, commercial activity. Is that a fair assessment?
I would love to see space mining get a hold. That plausibly could be the great economic engine that could get us moving out into the solar system. With that said, it seems a little bit early to start building that commercially. We need to sort of get the infrastructure out to kind of do the exploration to find the places worth mining, to develop the markets for space mine materials. But yes, in the long term, mining the asteroids, going out into space and mining the resources, that could be the big economic engine.
So Paul is in New York, and he says, I'm listening, David, and this has prompted a question, hence I'm sending it in by email. I think that's faster than calling. Dr. Landis, many people believe the great economic gold mine, if there is to be one in commercializing space, is cislunar economic development. And many people think that even today there are lots of pending cislunar economic opportunities available and many more that maybe we haven't thought about because the infrastructure isn't there yet. How do you see cislunar development with the private sector, and is it a potential commercial gold mine?
Well, in the near term, what it looks like, the big economic gold mine in cislunar space might very well be tourism. I think there's a lot of people who, if they were offered the opportunity, would love to go up to space hotels, would love to visit the moon as a tourist. And it's easy to sort of neglect that, but for a lot of countries, tourism can be a real economic gold mine. And then once you had tourism, of course, all of the infrastructure to support the tourism would want to be built up. And once you have the infrastructure, you can start using that for other things. So there's been a lot of people that are looking at that, the space tourism industry. It could be a big, big thing. It could be a huge economic industry.
Now, you're talking about orbital and destination tourism, not necessarily suborbital, correct?
Yes, possibly starting with the suborbital, and of course we have a couple of companies looking into that, but ultimately in space, people would love to go into orbit. They'd love to spend a week in an orbital hotel, and then maybe with a little bit more money, spend a couple of weeks on a visit to the moon.
Would you want to go?
Oh, absolutely. Sign me up.
Would to the moon or orbital or both?
Both. I'd certainly love to go to the moon.
If we put you on a ship to Mars, which is going to be a lot longer, maybe 3 years, I'm assuming you'd want to come back. Would you want to go to Mars, too?
Oh, sure. Yeah, Mars would be a fascinating destination. That's a long trip. That would be your...
And if we could go to Venus, which you have talked about for decades, would you go to 55 miles up in the Venusian atmosphere and go to a floating colony?
Yes, I think I'd love to visit the floating colonies, see how they work. Maybe if it's a nice enough place, stay there.
Probably wouldn't be very crowded, would it?
Well.
Tourism, that's... that's interesting, because that means that a lot of people on Earth have to have a lot of disposable income.
That's true.
So whatever we do on Earth with our economy would directly impact the ability for people to go spend their money on tourism. But that's another thing. We've been waiting for, you know, decades, and it hasn't really started to happen yet, although they keep saying it's getting closer and closer. Mars was just really close to Earth, and I guess it's moving a little further out now from Earth. So this has prompted a question from a student, hence my little sort of tepid introduction. So the student is David, also David, and he says he's in Tucson. David says, I'm a high school student. I've been listening to the space show, and I've heard you announcing that Mars was going to be very close to the Earth. I think you said this past Tuesday. I know that they only launch rockets to Mars when it is close to the Earth. What happens if they needed or wanted to launch a rocket or a mission to Mars, but it was at the other end of the orbit, pretty far away? Is it just that we don't have the rocket capability to do that? Is it too much money? Does the travel time take too long? Why do we have to launch only when Mars is close to Earth?
Well, all of those reasons are why we want to do the launch. In fact, we typically launch to Mars about 4 to 6 months before the closest approach of Mars and Earth, because, of course, it takes 8 to 11 months to get to Mars. But when Mars is on the far side of the sun, you're talking about a journey of perhaps 250 million miles to go all the way around. So it takes an enormous amount more energy to go to Mars if you miss that opportunity. It turns out there actually is a second opportunity that you could take if you had to. If Mars is in the wrong place, you could actually go in closer to the sun. You could do a Venus flyby and then go from Venus to Mars. It's a sort of the long way around, but it's something that if you absolutely had to do a trip to Mars, those opportunities come between the close opportunities.
How much longer would that extend the trip going to Mars?
It's a much longer trip if you do the Venus round trip. I wouldn't suggest doing the Venus flyby on purpose, but it just happens to be an opportunity that that comes at a different time. But with that said, it's only 2.2 years between Mars opportunities, so if you can't wait 2.2 years to launch, well, you really certainly are in a bit of a hurry.
Well, that does sound like a long time, and you know, for a lot of people. But I guess on space mission scale, it's not such a long time. Donnie, Donnie, is in Miami, Florida, and says, people have talked about other places that might be great for life, including Titan and Europa. Any thoughts on that? Any possibilities that even with nuclear propulsion that humans could get there?
Yeah, actually, I've been doing a lot of work in the last few years on robotic missions to the outer solar system, trying to look at what we can do. For human missions, it's a lot harder. I wouldn't say it's impossible, but it's harder. If you had a nuclear propulsion system, that would help a lot, because it's quite a long trip to Jupiter and even further to Saturn.
Saturn, yeah.
If you don't have a nuclear propulsion system. So I won't say that it's impossible, but that's another order of magnitude more difficult.
Are these places as promising for life or for humans to be there, as we sometimes hear from advocates of Titan and Europa?
These places are potential places for life, but not really for life as we know it. Titan, of course, is extremely cold on the surface. It's hundreds of degrees below zero. It does have weather. It has liquid on the surface, but it's not liquid water. It's liquid hydrocarbons. In fact, you could call it liquid natural gas on the surface of Titan. Takes the place of water. So if there were life on the surface of Titan, it would not be life as we know it. But what's interesting about Titan and the outer solar system is we know there's plenty of organic compounds in the outer solar system. Interestingly, organic compounds are pretty rare once you get inward from Mars. Earth is kind of an exception with organic compounds on the surface. Other than Earth, you don't see a lot of organic. But once you get to, the outer part of the asteroid belt and then Saturn and beyond, you see a lot of organic compounds. That sort of reddish color of Titan is mostly due to these compounds called tholins. These are very complicated hydrocarbon-based large molecules that, in fact, we don't know very much about. They're probably not life, but they very plausibly could have been the building blocks from which life is made. And when you look at Saturn and beyond, you see them everywhere. When you look at Pluto, you see the dusty red color, and that red color is tholins. It's these organic molecules. So it's very interesting for astrobiology, but don't expect life as we know it.
And don't expect to live there, I guess.
Well, you could probably learn to live there, but it might not be the best environment. If you went to, for example, Europa, Europa is deep within the radiation belts of Jupiter, so you'd want to bury yourself underneath the ice. So you might want to do that, particularly if you were studying the ocean underneath the ice. And that's what's so exciting about Europa, is that 10, 20, not really clear, but some distance below the ice, there's an ocean. We know the ocean's there because we can see it from the magnetic field measurements. So we might want to send humans there just as a scientific base in order to study that ocean.
You'd really need nuclear propulsion to get there.
You'd really want nuclear propulsion.
I mean,
it's
be
much harder to get there than Mars.
Ted, this is a different Ted. Ted is in Oklahoma City, and he says, does the recent announcement of phosphine in Venus really mean that there's probably life there?
A lot of people would like to know the answer to that question. I think right now the answer to that question is stay tuned. There's other missions to Venus that would like to learn more about that phosphine. What we can say mostly is that it is an unexplained phenomenon on Venus. We don't know why there's phosphorus, why there's phosphine in the atmosphere of Venus. Could it be life? Well, we don't know. It's certainly a hypothesis that's not yet ruled out.
Is Venus going to be competitive with Mars for mission funding? They're probably competitive already, but Mars, seems to be, the top winner. Does this announcement make Venus a lot more interesting and move it up in priority?
Well, that's sort of a job for the space science, and particularly for the Space Science Decadal Survey. This is a study that's going on right now to try to come up with the important science questions for future exploration, that is to say, science exploration of the solar system. So they're just embarking on this study to answer the question, what are the most important science destinations to study in this upcoming decade? So again, that's one we'll have to say, well, stay tuned. The Decadal Survey will write their report and tell us what they think the important science questions are.
Do you see any openings at all for commercial funding of science missions because the commercial funders want them rather than letting the scientists decide what's important through the Decadal Survey? If there's funding for commercials to want to go look at Venus and they raise the money to do a Venus mission, what do you think about that? I don't know that it would happen, but you know, there may be groups that have an interest and they don't want to be dependent upon the government saying yes or no, it's possible to do a mission.
Actually, there is a lot of commercial interest right now in doing missions, and in fact, Venus is one of the places that people are talking about going to with commercial missions. So, yeah, that's not impossible at all. It's especially with the new launch vehicle companies that are trying to lower the price of space missions. There's a company called Rocket Lab.
Right.
And they build a vehicle called the Electron Booster. And they've announced that they want to send their own private mission to Venus. It'll be a sort of a demonstration for their small spacecraft to show that their small spacecraft can work. But it also is something that they just want to do. They say, hey, we've got the rocket. We know how to build spacecraft. Let's send our own mission to Venus. And they're proposing to do this entirely on their own. It's not part of a spacecraft.
As a scientist, do you have any problem with commercials doing that?
Oh, absolutely no problem whatsoever. There's been a long history, actually, of scientific expeditions on the Earth being funded by private entities. So go for it.
You have another caller wanting to talk to you. Hello, caller. Who are you and where are you? And we appreciate your calling today. Caller, are you there? Hello, hello, hello. They're there because the phone has not been hung up upon yet. Caller, are you there? Going once, twice. Okay.
Looks like they have the mute button working.
Caller, if you want to call back, please give us a call back. It is 866-687-7223. Helen in Seattle says, how do you see the future for a lunar exploration base where you could go to other planets a lot cheaper by launching on the moon? That is often talked about. Do you see that as a realistic goal or something that can be accomplished?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, and a lot of the people analyzing have gone sort of back and forth on that question. Would it be easier to do planetary exploration if we started from the moon rather than starting from Earth? Of course, the moon has a much smaller gravity well, so starting from the moon would be an easier place, but of course you have to get to the moon first. That would mostly be something that would be useful if we can make rocket fuel on the moon. If we can refuel on the moon, then it might be worth making the stop on the moon and using that as a fueling stop to go to Mars, to go to Venus, to go to the outer solar system. If we don't have the technology to refuel at the moon, it's probably sort of just a waste of time to stop on the moon on the way going to somewhere else.
Is there any reason why we wouldn't have fueling and refueling capabilities on the moon? Is there something about that process or the moon that would prevent that technology from being developed?
I'm sure that we could develop that technology. It's more a question of all of the many pieces of space infrastructure we want to make where are we going to put our efforts? Are we going into maybe people would want to put their efforts more into just going directly to Mars and not building infrastructure on the moon? People have certainly argued both ways, so I wouldn't argue against it, but it complicates the process. It means now we're building up a complicated process with an additional step.
So for future reference, when I have callers or guests on the space show talking as if this is a slam dunk potential for being on the moon, take it with a grain of salt.
Oh, I wouldn't necessarily take it with a grain of salt, but keep in mind that there are arguments both ways. That if you're proposing using the moon as a base, you're proposing a much more complicated system. And there's advantage sometimes to the simple system of, well, if you want to go to Mars, just go directly to Mars.
Roger has sent in a note, and listeners, there's still time. If you want to call us, 1-866-687-7223. Roger's in Phoenix, and he says, I know you work for NASA, so I'm not sure you care to comment on my question, but is Artemis the best way to return to the moon in your understanding of engineering and what it takes and what's involved in getting humans back to the moon?
Yeah, that's one that I suppose I should preface by saying that the Back to the Moon project isn't one of the projects that I'm currently heavily involved in. So I'd have to say there's other people who are studying how to go to the moon and what you do once you get there. I'm just happy that we are going to the moon, but I'm not designing or advocating one way to get there over another.
Do you opine about or comment about the efforts to get some sort of quasi or limited private property rights for commercial space activities?
That has been a big arguing point in the space law community for decades.
Right.
Is what is the status of private property rights on the moon? I think I tend to agree with the people who argue that you have to have private property rights on the moon in order to get real commercialization going. That if you tie it up in a big rights argument, that you'll never get the investors to say, oh, we're going to put the mining and manufacturing on the moon, if they're worried that the lawyers are going to eventually say, you don't have the permission to do this. So I think I will go in, and this is my personal opinion, not the opinion of any organization that I may work with. My personal opinion is that, yes, we have to have private property rights on the moon. It's just we're not going to get what we want without it.
So I have another email, Jake from Dallas. Now, this is kind of on the fringe, but, you know, I'm going to ask you anyway, and if you want to duck it, that's fine. Jake in Dallas said, several years ago, the Navy either willingly or unwillingly got released photos of F-18s coming in contact with unbelievably performing vehicles known as Tic Tac. And there's a lot of speculation about what they may be, the kind of propulsion they're using, even what the materials are made of or where they are from. Do you believe there are extraterrestrial cultures or civilizations out there? Do you think we can ever contact them? What is your thought about the kind of propulsion maneuvering that Tic Tacs seem to exhibit, if you're familiar with those Navy videos?
Yeah, well, I have to say I have looked at some of those videos, and at the moment I'm just mostly saying, well, I'm going to hold off on judgment here. They say unidentified flying object, but another way you could call it is unidentified radar signals.
and it's just not clear whether it's real or a glitch in the radar. And I have to say that my personal answer to that is I don't know. I don't really have access to the detailed analysis that would even begin to answer that question.
Do you think there is life out there someplace, and can we contact it, or would we ever contact it?
That is the biggest question ever, is there life out there? When you look at the numbers, you're tempted to say, oh, my God, there has to be life out there. There are, as Carl Sagan said, billions and billions of stars out there. And he was actually underestimating the number. So you'd be really tempted to say there has to be life out there. But at the moment, we don't know. We have to just keep looking. Maybe we can find it.
What about on Mars? Do you think there's probable signs of past life that would confirm that, or maybe microbes there today?
Well, what we know now is that in the very early solar system, Mars was a much more habitable planet. Mars had a thicker atmosphere. Mars had water on the surface. And it took a very long time for Mars to dry up and cool down. So the argument is that, at least on the planet Earth, life seems to have appeared almost instantly in geological terms, as soon as the oceans were cool enough that there could be liquid water on the surface. So it's very easy to argue the same must have been true for Mars. That if life started so quickly on Earth, it should have also started on Mars, when Mars had liquid water on the surface, plausibly a global ocean, before it dried out and cooled down. And then the argument from there goes, well, on the planet Earth, you can find life pretty much any place where you can find liquid water, even part of the time on the surface. And we know that part of the time there's liquid water on Mars. It's probably very, very salty water, but still water. So there's a good argument there could be life on Mars. So far, we haven't found it. And we have been looking. But some of the next missions to Mars will have much more sophisticated equipment to look for life. And maybe we can find where it's hiding. A lot of people have proposed that if there's life on Mars, it might be underground. And so far, we've drilled a couple of centimeters into Mars. We've not gone very deep under the surface.
Right.
So maybe we need to fly a more robust drill that can drill down, perhaps look at some of the underground aquifers on Mars and see if there's life further deep underneath the surface of the soil.
Would we recognize it if we saw it?
Wow, that is a good question. If it's Earth-like life, we know how to recognize terrestrial life. We look for proteins. We look for lipids. We look for nucleic acid. We look for many of these complicated organic compounds. But the real tough question is, well, what if it's not Earth-like? What if it's a completely different biology? What if it's a completely different chemistry? Would we know it when we see it? Well, we might not even know what to look for. That's a hard question. But it's hard to answer the how do you look for something when you don't know what you're looking for and you don't know what it would look like if you found it. So,
would you be surprised if some kind of life was found either in the past or present on Mars? Would that surprise you?
I'm thinking it's very reasonable that in the past there had been life on Mars. The question is, would it have managed to survive all the way to the present day? Well, we know that if there's life on Mars, it's microscopic, because we've observed Mars for long enough to know that there's nothing obvious on the surface, nothing big on the surface. So I would be amazed. I would be astounded. I would be standing up and cheering. But I'm probably not going to put my bets on extant Martian life right now. I'm going to hold off on that.
What should we have talked about during our almost 90 minutes that we've omitted or forgotten or that you wanted to continue talking about, but maybe we got digressed onto something else?
Oh, I'm not sure. We certainly have ranged pretty far. We talked about making oxygen on Mars. We haven't really talked about human missions, but we've sort of brushed up against the idea of human missions, which I think almost certainly would be using propellant manufactured on Mars. I think we've covered a lot of topics.
Well, I have one 11th hour sort of email, and this is Rodney, and Rodney's in Salt Lake City. And he says, I find it interesting that a lot of space science fiction, not necessarily with monsters coming to Earth and killing people and that type of thing, but good science fiction often seems to end up being reality several years down the road on a mission, or a mission might have something that's very close to what was in a science fiction book many, many years earlier. Do science fiction authors have a way of imagining the future that comes true, or how do they manage to put things in science fiction that become real? Do space engineers read science fiction and then try to model what they build and develop from science fiction?
Well, partly I think it's because science fiction writers are fascinated by science and engineering. And, of course, they are. If they weren't fascinated by science and engineering, they'd write something else. Perhaps they'd write mysteries or some Hollywood movies. So you have a group of people that are just fascinated with science and engineering, and they do follow the reports. They read the most recent science news and then try to go one step beyond and say what could be possible in the future. But also, you're absolutely true. Scientists and engineers often read science fiction, so it goes the other way, too. The science fiction writers read the science, and the scientists and engineers read the science fiction and say, well, wait a second, maybe I could make that. Maybe I could make that a reality. So science feeds into science fiction, and science fiction feeds back into science.
You have one more email that has come in, and Kim, who called you a little while ago, this time has sent in an email. What would be involved with putting a probe in the atmosphere of Venus that stays aloft at the altitude of interest? What's the main technical hurdle?
Well, there isn't a technical hurdle. The technical hurdle is we need somebody to fund the mission and do it. The reason that I say there's no technical hurdle is because we've done it. The Soviet mission Vega back in the 1980s went to Halley's Comet, but on the way to Halley's Comet, it dropped two probes into the atmosphere of Venus. They landed on the surface, but they also released two balloons that floated in the atmosphere for 4 days. So we know we can float in the atmosphere with, I'd call it a robotic mission, with robotic balloons, because the Soviets did it. In fact, they floated in the atmosphere for 4 days, and after that, the wind blew them around onto the far side of the planet. So we're not sure how long they actually lasted, although probably once they got into the sunlight, they overheated and failed. But they lasted as long as we could watch them. We saw the Vega balloons.
So balloons could be inserted at 55 miles mm-hmm. kilometer, just like something
yep.
is inserted in a lunar orbit or a Martian orbit.
Yeah. Drop it into the atmosphere, inflate the balloon at high altitude, and you can fly. Although I will say that I've been very much an advocate of flying a solar-powered airplane in the atmosphere of Venus. There is, once you're above the clouds, there's plenty of solar power, and you could create, if you will, you'd call it a Venus drone, that should be able to fly forever in the atmosphere of Venus. And there's a lot to be said for a powered airplane. You can fly where you want, fly up and down. You don't just go where the wind takes you.
What would you inflate the balloons with? What are they filled with?
The ones that were flown before, I believe, were helium balloons. Helium, of course, is eventually going to leak out. So you're either going to have to replenish it with more helium that you brought from the Earth. I like the idea of inflating the balloons with air, because I like the idea that eventually you can put humans in the balloon and you'd like to have a breathable atmosphere. Air is also a lifting gas in the carbon dioxide atmosphere. But probably if you didn't have humans, you'd probably use one of the lighter gases, hydrogen, helium, possibly methane. Methane's also a good lifting gas on Venus.
Well, maybe we'll get to see that happen in the not-too-distant future.
I hope so.
Well, lots of us hope so. Jeff, I want to thank you for returning to the space show and talking with us about the issues and possibilities and missions and technology. It's been fascinating, and we'll stay in touch, and I look forward to catching up with you again down the road and do it again and see how much has changed and what more we know. So that's always fun to do.
Okay, well, thank you. It was great to talk to you again.
Thank you, and listeners, that's it for today. So open lines is Sunday. So I want to thank the callers and the emails, Dr. Landis for sure, and everyone else who participated in today's program. It's the weekend, so make it count and be safe and healthy and always keep looking up. And you can still see Mars. It's still bright in the sky. It's just not as bright as it was Tuesday night. Everybody have a great, safe weekend. Goodbye from the space show.